Oh, it's all right, Mr. Daly. You're perfectly safe.
Well, of course I am. Why wouldn't I be?
Why indeed?
I will have that drink now, Jim. Vodka and tonic, if you've got it.
Oh, I've got it.
Welcome to episode 36 of the Minder podcast in association with Minder.org. I am your host, Paul Stenning. In this episode, which will be the last of 2024, we are going to look at the classic episode, Whose Wife Is It Anyway? I've had some great feedback regarding my investigations into some of the lesser known aspects of Minder. There's been more interest in these types of shows than some of the interviews, to be honest, so I think you're going to like this one. Though I must point out, we do go deep into the background, so if that's not of interest to you, then well, come back another time. This is, as you will know if you listen to the Top 10 Episode Show, my favourite all-time episode of Minder. I know it is for some of you too, or at the very least, an episode you like a lot. I've wanted to do this one for a while, and I've been building up tidbits here and there, ready to get down and look into it all at some point. As we featured location manager Dave Shanks last episode, I wanted to follow up with this one. And so I have put together as much as I can regarding this episode, and have, pardon the expression, blown myself away in terms of what I discovered. As usual with many Minder episodes, there was much more than met the eye. What appeared to be a straightforward comedy drama was anything but. This show is going to be in three sections. We have the first section about the episode itself, just covering the basics. Then we have the writing inspiration, some of the links which influenced the story. Finally, we will cover the unusual material which links to the episode, including insight into the locations used and why this was used, as well as lots of trivia relating to the episode. Why do I love this episode more than any other? Well, it has to be Alan Lewis. So a brief word on that before we start. Most of the other characters I have seen him play are fairly fierce and intense. He can be quite scary, in fact. He is not often likeable, and I don't think I have seen him play a gay character in anything else. He was, in fact, quite a surprising choice in this role. And if you think about it, there were never really any other gay characters in Minder. There were the odd references, and a few characters who were briefly in a scene or two. I'm thinking, tantalise, tantalise. But otherwise, Minder stayed away from featuring gays. Perhaps that is because a gay man was not such a common occurrence as today. Before it was fashionable to be different, people had to work much harder to feel comfortable being themselves, especially if being so was shunned by society. I grew up seeing gay men and drag queens as I lived in Brighton for the first 9 years of my life, but elsewhere it was completely different. We moved to the north, and I don't think I saw a gay again until I was in my mid-teens and walked through the gay village in Manchester for the first time. Anyway, back to Jolly Jim, played by Alan Lewis. If you listen to Stuart St. Paul's interview, there is some great insight into the man, the character, and this episode. And as I told Stuart, I just think Alan played the best guest slot in Minder history, and that's saying something. It's not just the over-serious and yet comical portrayal of an iron, with his references to bark and mule mariné. It's as much about his petulance and underhanded meddling behind the scenes. He inadvertently put his boyfriend in hospital and begins to sell off all his stock, for God's sake. And yet he is totally likeable, but then he isn't. He's a stuck-up snob as well. What a combination, and very hard to play. Just two reasons why this is a standout episode. But there is so much more to it, as well you know. And that's before we start with the things you'll never have heard before. Before we start, a note just to point out that if it were not for the hard work of Jonathan and other fans from Minder.org, I would not have gone on some of the wild goose chases I found, and much of this info would have remained undiscovered. So it is thanks to his and others' tireless work in sourcing the real locations from Minder that helped me to begin my research into the location connections. So are you ready to feel a little bit more gay than before listening? It's time to get jolly, as long as you have nothing against irons. Part 1, the episode. Broadcast at 9 o'clock on the 18th of September 1980, Whose Wife Is It Anyway? Was the second episode of Series 2 of Minder. Bear in mind, Series 2 was a big risk for Houston Films. They did not have immediate positive feedback from Series 1, and they really weren't sure whether it was going to work long term or not. They knew, of course, that it was great, but that does not necessarily mean a hit. Sometimes people just don't get it immediately, and for whatever reason, Minder took a while to become a hit. Perhaps this episode helped, as it was just so different. Very classy, and yet silly at the same time. Directed by Roy Ward Baker and written by Tony Hoare, Whose Wife Is It Anyway? Was filmed in March 1980. It was incidentally only the second episode written by Hoare, who would go on to write 20 altogether. It was the fourth episode directed by Roy Ward Baker. The story concerns Arthur persuading Terry he needs to help out minding an antique shop, which belongs to a friend of his, Alex, one of your own, a real man's man, etc. There has been a bit of aggro, with Alex being involved in some kind of altercation, which has landed him in hospital, with mere abrasions. Only later does Terry find out that Alex has almost broken every bone in his body. Alex, played by David Dacre, is indeed in a full body cast, though it doesn't take much imagination or great eyesight to see that Alex is lying down in bed under a plaster body shape that is barely touching his neck, much less protecting it. Dacre, incidentally, normally known for playing very tough characters, is perfect as the slightly embarrassed gay, showing snippets of sensitivity mixed with anger. The anger becomes obvious as the story unfolds, but at first Dacre is very nonplussed and calm, speaking in hushed tones about his partner, Jim.
Take seconds.
Well, what's that then?
Well, you know, I'm in the antique game. Got a nice high-class shop in Kensington. And a sort of partner. He knows how to handle the kind of upmarket punter we get.
And?
Well, Jim, that's my partner. He tells me that a couple of hooligans have been in the shop at the demand.
What, protection?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not the most difficult thing in the world, is it? To smash a Ming vase or to break up a Louis XVI chair.
Or a human frame.
Exactly.
So you think this might have been deliberate? To get you off the plot?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it seems a bit drastic. Yeah, I mean, I might have been killed. Maybe somebody just taking advantage of me being out of the way. I mean, I'm still a bit useful, Arthur. And I'd smash any bastard who tried to collect protection off me. Oh, Jimmy's.
Once you know he is gay and watch the performance again, it is easy to see the abashed way in which he describes his partner, who just happens to live in the flat too. That would be the spare bedroom. Terry is very reluctant to move in with someone he doesn't know in order to mind the shop, but Arthur persuades him of all the positives of living somewhere at market and not having much to do in terms of work, expanding his mind. It is only upon meeting Alex's friend Jim, played by Alan Lewis, that within seconds Terry weighs up that Jim is in fact Jolly Jim, a raving iron. For those unfamiliar with the Cockney rhyming slang, the word iron refers to being a puff, coming from the rhyming slang of iron hoof, puff. I should have really put a warning at the beginning about people sensitive to such terms in this day and age, but nevertheless, you know when we're talking about, this was 1980. I don't walk around saying, I enough now. Arthur plays complete ignorance at the notion Jim is gay, and in fact this is mostly genuine. At first we are to think that Arthur knows Jim is gay, and puts Terry in there anyway, but it later emerges that Arthur is as surprised as anyone, to learn his mate, a real hard case, has left his wife and kids and become a queen. So this episode is also part mystery, because nothing really makes sense until towards the end. The viewer is as in the dark as both Terry and Arthur. But it is Terry who begins to suss something is not right, and begins to put the story together. Through a combination of talking with and sleeping with Alex's wife Gloria, played by Janet Key, and asking around the local antique shops, he discovers that not one of them has had anyone demanding money from them. It means Jim is in a minority of one, and his story begins to crumble. But even this only really makes sense at the end, when the two so-called gangsters who come into the shop and attack Arthur, as well as give Terry the runaround, are actually mutual friends of Alex and Jim, and it has all been a setup by Jolly Jim. Alex and Jim get into a very camp yet emotional and somewhat endearing discussion at the end, to which Arthur and Terry can only make their polite excuses to leave, though not before Arthur writes his number on Alex's leg cast to ensure he can contact him if he needs to, promising to send Terry at a more convenient time to pick up payment. There are some little side scenes in the episode, such as Terry visiting his gran before Arthur follows. The difference between how she is with Terry and then Arthur is a real gem of writing. Many of you have probably been there, where a member of your family seems to lose all interest in you, but then suddenly jumps to attention with great interest when someone new appears. Quite why Terry's gran would even know Arthur is never explained, but it works.
P6 is therefore effectively in parallel with the load at position 1.
Do you like it, Gran?
P6 becomes comparable with Q.
The watch. Do you like it?
Reduced, oh, yes. And the gain very falls. Nice. Very nice.
So you'll find that even with the lowering at high and low frequencies, the amplifier with resistive loads will amplify a wide band of frequencies.
Fancy a cup of tea, Gran?
That would be nice.
The bandwidth can be increased by lowering the gain.
Terrific.
Gran, and of Arthur's here to see you. Happy birthday. Little something for you.
Oh, I say.
No, don't get up.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Daly. Well, I don't know what to say. Aren't they lovely, Terry?
Yeah, lovely.
I guess go and put them in a vase of water. And chocolates as well. Oh, I say. I'll get you a cup of tea.
Lovely.
Are they lovely?
I didn't know you bought the flowers as well. Would you like to watch? What are you doing here? Got a job for you.
Then there is Arthur selling dodgy watches, which all seem to tell the wrong time or stop. He is particularly brazen and unsympathetic in selling a dodgy watch to the sister of the ward where he visits Alex. Selling her the merits of her own dedication to her job, and promising she needs a very accurate timepiece when he has anything but, is rather callous, but again it works to establish Arthur's dedication to business. And yet we also see the other side of him, a genuinely caring friend, who wants to see Alex and Gloria together as a family, with the kids, and goes to visit her to try and work out what's gone wrong between them. Then there is his total disappointment that his hard case mate has turned gay. It's not so much about him being gay, more that Arthur is seemingly hurt by the betrayal to Alex's wife, as he considers them both his friend. Gloria, however, doesn't believe Arthur is really anyone's friend, which seems a bit harsh. We also see Arthur as briefly vulnerable when he is in the shop alone, not to mention when he is alone with Jim. Firstly, when he feels rather under the spotlight, all alone with a gay man, and secondly, when he is accosted by leather glove-wearing gangster gays, though he didn't know they were two at the time. So really, this is one of the few times where Terry doesn't really mind anything, but rather shows his other side, that of the general detective and someone with a very canny instinct. Even if he loses himself in the moment sometimes, though. For instance, when he goes into the gay bar with Jim and seems blissfully unaware it's all geezers around him. He's just having a pint talking about the Winchester. Terry is also part of a terrific roof chase scene, which just looks great. Not sure if there was a stuntman used for that one. There isn't one credited for this episode. But unlike other scenes sometimes in Minder, it actually looked like Terry doing the running. Part 2. Writing Inspiration. The title, Whose Life Is It Anyway?, comes from a 1972 TV movie originally, although it was later remade. The plot involves Ken, who is a sculptor, who is involved in a car accident and is paralysed. He can only talk. This heartwarming story is about his fight with the law and the medics for the right to die with dignity. Lovely. So not much there with any relevance to the Minder episode. I think it was simply a good use of a pun from writer Tony Hoare. So what was his writing inspiration? As we have seen previously with Tony Hoare, he did like to take stories from here and there and turn them into Minder episodes. There were other influences, which we will get to in part three, but the most obvious one comes from Steptoe and Son. Any Old Iron comes from episode 3 in series 5 of the famous series, surely, by the way, in the top 5 British comedies ever made. The plot involves an elderly antique dealer who comes to the Steptoe yard. As he appears to be so cultured, Harold sees the opportunity to befriend someone with intelligence and class. But there is more than meets the eye to Timothy Stanhope, played by Richard Herndall. Steptoe Senior knows immediately that Stanhope is an iron, but Harold has to find out the hard way. Albert Steptoe has a real thing against puffs, which is ironic if you know anything about Wilfred Bramble. As with Arthur and his wife, who looks genuinely crestfallen in learning his friend Alex is gay, Albert Steptoe is totally horrified by the idea of his son turning. There are a few similarities directly with the Minder episode, and it seems Tony Hoare was simply paying tribute to Steptoe in his own way. For instance, he switched the story of Any Old Iron and reversed the roles a little. Some of the quotes and conversation are very similar. The difference was Harold was initially drawn in by the gay man, unlike Terry. So much so, in fact, that Albert believes Harold might be on the turn. There is another comparison to Who's Wife in that the Timothy Stanhope character cooks for Harold, just like Jim cooks for Terry.
Don't go out tonight, Harold. Stay here with me.
I'm sorry, Father. I'm having dinner with Timmy.
Dinner? Where?
If you must know. At his flat.
Oh, don't go, Harold. Not to his flat. Ask him round here. I'll cook up some fish and chips. And we'll use your mother's best fish knives. They're still in the box. Please, Harold, don't go to his flat. It's a trap.
It's a business conference. It's a working dinner. It happens that he's found some premises that would make a nice little antique shop for me, and he's going to put the money up.
The filthy swine.
He's doing me a favour.
What's he getting out of it?
The share of the profits. I mean, look, it's a straightforward business deal. It's what we've always wanted. But you're included.
Not me, mate. I wouldn't take a penny of his money. He's not going to get away with it. I'll make you a ward of court. I'll have the police on him for corrupting a minor.
Dad, I'm 39 years old.
Al, don't do it. Turn back before it's too late. Come back on the straight and narrow. All right, then. Go. I don't care. I know what's going to happen to you, mate. You'll finish up in a drag show down to Skinner's Arms.
Did you enjoy the main course?
Oh, it was absolutely superb. What was it?
That was Jarry de Vaux Ménagère.
Yes. Yes, I thought it was. That's beautiful.
I wasn't too sure about the wine.
Oh, no, no. Your fears were groundless. The Chateau Lafitte Rothschild 59 was a perfect compliment to the Jarry de the meat.
Oh, I'm so glad, only I'm not a great wine drinker myself.
How aren't you? No. Oh, then it's something I can educate you on.
Oh.
Oh, yes. As Montaigne once said, a meal without wine is like a day without sunshine.
Oh. Was that Montaigne?
I believe it was. It was either him or Fanny Craddock.
Have some more wine.
Oh, no, here, hang on, hang on. You'll get me Brahms and Liszt in a minute. Now, about a little bit of business. I mean, I'll feel at the sight you have
chosen. No, not now, dear boy. We'll talk business later.
There was also an earlier Steptoe and Son episode about an antiques dealer, Crossed Swords, from Series 4. The dealer, played by Derek Nimmo, is a full-on iron, something which probably went into young Tony Hoare's psyche. Incidentally, Molly Vaness, who plays Terry's gran in Who's Wife, once appeared in an episode of Steptoe and Son, an episode which also featured Peggy Thorpe Bates, who would later show up in You Lose Some, You Win Some. Victoria Fenton, the sister on the ward who buys Arthur's dodgy watch, once appeared in an episode of Rings on Their Fingers, which starred Diane Keane, later in The Dessert Song. It's also interesting to note that Minder became renowned for using rhyming slang, and in this episode the use of the word iron was of course the most memorable. Slang was also used in sitcom Birds of a Feather, particularly by a main character Sharon and Tracy, often to the confusion of character Dorian Green, who was unfamiliar with the terms. Dorian was played by Leslie Joseph, who would appear in Minder again in You Lose Some, You Win Some. Alan Lewis was also, of course, in Birds of a Feather, 51 episodes in fact, and he also wrote two of them. We are made distinctly aware in the Who's Wife episode that Arthur's friends are named Gloria and Alex Brompton. This name was no accident. During the 1930s, all the way up to the 1970s, there were a number of antiques dealers on Brompton Road, and the old Brompton Road, which was just down the road, would later become synonymous with the gay scene. This shows an extraordinary level of attention to detail from Tony Hoare. The name Brompton refers both to the gay scene as well as antiques history in London. This, I believe, is the reason it is used frequently throughout the episode. Not only do we hear the surname spoken, but there are many shots which focus on the name of the shop from the outside. This was not the real name of the shop, of course, so it was purposely placed on the front of the window and shown often for some other reason. I believe this was to underline the secrecy aspect of Hoare's writing. He was referring to antiques being full of irons and also the need certain people had to forge a fictitious identity. The old Brompton Road would have represented a safe haven for the gay person of the 1970s and 80s, and perhaps it was also easier for a well-dressed dandy to hide behind the legitimacy of the antiques business.
Of course, you know I'm gay.
Well, it had crossed my mind, yeah.
And does it bother you?
No. Why should it?
Well, it seemed to make your friend uncomfortable.
Ah, well, yeah, Arthur, he's a bit old-fashioned, like, you know, age creeping on.
Can't be much older than Alex.
Arthur thinks that you and Alex are just good friends.
Yes, I gathered that.
Part 3. Real-life inspiration and locations. The house in which Alex and Gloria had lived together before he became a queen was in St Albans Grove, South Kensington, not too far away at all from Earl's Court. It's actually less than a mile to Old Brompton Road from St Albans Grove, a house, by the way, that is today worth around 11 million. Even Notting Hill Gate is not much further away, so it is certainly likely that Alex would travel from his home in South Kensington, both one way to the antique shop and the other to Old Brompton Road to the gay area. Just before 13 minutes into the episode, we first see the antique shop on the corner at number 68 Ledbury Road in Notting Hill, where most of this episode is filmed. At the time, the real name of this shop was Casio Antiques. Dave Shanks confirmed that all internal shots of Alex and Jim's flat were filmed at 73 Artesian Road, next door to the shop. So as the shop bends round and you see Terry and Arthur briefly come out of that door, that is supposed to signify the entrance to the upstairs, but the real upstairs, and the upstairs used in the episode, was in fact in the house next door to that, on the road that goes on the side next to the shop. It was confirming this information that really set me off on looking into the building and the shop itself, both from then and now. First of all, it's a great location and a beautiful building inside and out. Despite the camp inclusions, such as the rose on the bed and the fancy curtains, which may or may not have been there in real life, it's a really classy place in itself. The building, being on the corner of Artesian Road, touches what's known as the Artesian Village, which may or may not have been around in 1980, but as far as I know, the Cock and Bottle pub was and is still there today. I did some digging and found that Casio Antiques was incorporated in 1964, and owned by Douglas John Pound and his partner, one Beaudoin Mills, that is spelt B-E-A-U-D-O-I-N, Beaudoin, it's French, as you can tell. Beaudoin Mills, who now lives in Monaco. Interesting name, I thought, and the geezer is still alive, though impossible to find unless I write to him at his home address, maybe for another time. And so the original shop used in Who's Wife was known as Casio Antiques, but was changed for the episode to Brompton Antiques, for obvious reasons. This was indeed a real shop operating in West London, on the corner of Artesian Road and Ledbury Road. Where my research took me into very interesting areas was when I searched whether this was still going today. It is, though it is now known as Brora, a chain shop selling luxury Scottish clothing. It almost ended up as a restaurant at one stage.
Oh, my God.
No more for me, thanks, friend.
Oh, Terry, everything all right?
I trust mine's not the bedroom with all the fancy curtains and that.
Fancy curtains?
That's right. Yours is a spare bedroom.
Oh, that'll be Alex's room when he's here.
Well, I expect you'll be wanting to collect a few items. Toothbrush, what have you?
Yeah, I suppose so. I'll do that for you. Better stay now you're here. I mean, you never know when those hooligans are going to come back. I mean, they didn't give any indication, did they?
No, they didn't.
Well, give us the keys to your flat. On it round tonight and chuck a few things in a bag for you.
Well, I'll come down to the car.
No, there's no need for that.
I'll come down anyway.
Oh, right. Well, I'll be going then. It's very nice to... And as I say, with Terry here, you have got nothing to worry about.
How very reassuring. These are Alex's keys. You'd better take them to let yourself in. In case we're not here when you bring Terry's things.
Not here?
Well, I may decide to go out.
Out where?
Out. I'm not a prisoner, am I?
Well, no, but it'll be...
That'll be all right as long as Terry accompanies you.
Oh, come now, it's the shop they're interested in protecting, not me.
No, but it's from you they want to claim their contribution, isn't it?
Oh, so be it. About food.
Food?
Yes, food. You do eat, I suppose.
Well, he has been known to eat beans.
Beans?
Yeah, human beans.
Ah, I see a joke.
Terrific.
Outside you.
Hey, what was all that about the bedroom?
Oh, it's super.
You are wrong about Alex.
Oh, yeah.
Moule Marinière. I do hope you like them.
Shells look like they'd be a bit hard.
Well, you must admit, it sounds a bit dodgy, Arthur.
Dodgy? You sound like Terry. Listen, if you knew this Alex, you wouldn't call him a woofter to his face, I can tell you that.
Yeah, how's Terry taken to having to stay with the other one?
Well, he loves it, don't he?
And so we have the original Cassio Antiques, which was owned by one Beaudoin Mills, and he was the owner of the real antique shop used in Whose Wife Is It Anyway? Now, the real-life Mr. Mills was an interesting character. It's an unusual name for a start. Beaudoin, incidentally, comes from the Germanic Baldwin, originally meaning audacious friend. I think he certainly would have been that. For many years, Mills was involved with Shirley Bassey, both as a partner and as her manager. One newspaper piece said the following. A Bassey fan describes him as the flamboyant, slippery French-Canadian antiques dealer Beau, was often pictured with Dame Shirley in later years at various events. However, he was viewed with suspicion among Bassey fans and appears to have been absent in recent years. Once upon a time, he developed himself as an amateur manager of Bassey, but not really one with gusto, always in for the quick gigs for the most money. He did her record deals and part of her concerts during the 80s and part of the 90s. It is my belief, having looked into this in depth now, that Tony Hoare had some very unusual connections and based the character of Jim on Beaudoin Mills, using his shop in the process. It may even have been a selling point to him. There is simply no way the character of Jim was not based on the real-life owner of that very shop. But as you know, as a viewer, this has never been stated before, so I think it was just something of a trade secret. After all, Beaudoin in real life was not even supposed to be gay, much like Alex Brompton. In fact, Shirley Bassey made a habit of hooking up with men who were actually gay. It was all just a front. Take a look at the photos on the Minder podcast site, and you will see a very great resemblance between Beaudoin and Jim as well. He even wears red. Today, by the way, Beaudoin lives in Monaco and appears at one stage to have fallen out with Shirley Bassey. David Shanks told me that Beaudoin was elegant, camp, life and soul, until he wasn't. Sharp business-wise, not averse to cash deals, but I doubt would be directly involved in dodgy. When we look at photos of Beaudoin, he does indeed look very stylish, much like Jim in the episode. This was not a mistake. Yes, of course, antiques dealers are going to carry themselves very well, and look the part. But being smart is one thing. Being a dandy is quite different. And Jim is much more a dandy than just a well-dressed chap. I found that the wardrobe people who worked on the episode were well into middle age at the time, almost in their 60s. I'm sure this would have helped them get the right feel for the character, and they were indeed very experienced. Iris Richens had worked on Thunderbirds, but she had been out of the business, on TV at least, until beginning to work on Series 2 of Minder. She had worked on National Pelmet, so Whose Wife was her second Minder episode. Philip Pickford was the wardrobe supervisor, and had been there from the beginning of the show. So a little more on the proof behind the connection between the character of Jim and Mr. Mills. As far as Dave Shanks can remember, the location was already in place. He merely had to supervise the overall locale and work with the owner, Baudouin, of the shop to be used in the episode. Dave told me, "I remember it was one of the locations that my innocence worked in favour of the production. The shop and the area was obviously perfect for the episode. When I first went past it, I was advised that it would be difficult to film there, partly due to the logistical problems of that area, but mainly because the owner was difficult to deal with. I decided to go for broke and ask the owner whether they had problems with filming previously, and how could we reassure him. I also explained that I wasn't going to try to buy a solution, but that I was quite happy to be open about our requirements and would ensure that we kept within our agreement. I was dealing with Baudouin directly, and over a drink in a local wine bar, he suddenly opened up and explained that a previous disagreement with the film crew had happened, and he'd thrown a tantrum and chucked the crew out. There was nothing I could say, except that I and this crew would respect him and all the members of his staff, at which point he suddenly offered the building next door, so we got both locations at the same time. When Terry walks along Ledbury Road, he is seen close to the Walmer Castle pub. When he later hangs from a metal beam before being rescued by the fire service, he is round the corner from the pub on Wellington Close. The pub, by the way, was later owned by David Beckham and Guy Ritchie. It is funny, incidentally, that many of you have told me you loved hearing Dave Shanks talk about locations back in the early 80s because it reminded you of the real London. I couldn't agree more, as I too was reminded of visiting London when I was a mere slip of a lad living in Brighton. To put things in perspective now, when you look up these locations that look so shabby in the 80s, they're often much cleaner and nicer looking, it has to be said, but there is a price to match. For instance, Terry's Grand's house is today worth £1.3 million, and it still looks pretty much the same. I'm sure it's a bit nicer inside, but come on. Back then, I'm guessing it was worth less than £40,000. Yet, now we're talking prime real estate, being in West Kensington. I was interested to see which antique shops were still going in the area and contacted them to see if I could get anywhere. They were polite enough to reply if they didn't know anything, but one in particular, Paul Martin of Robin Martin Antiques on 44 Ledbury Road, responded in a bit more depth. "Hello," he says, "thanks for your email. We've been here for a long time, but I don't remember any Minder filming, I'm afraid. Looks as if it was filmed on the other end of Ledbury heading north. Rex Antiques, Michael Davidson and Briggs Antiques." Well, he's right about that because you can see those in the episode. Paul carries on. "I think I'd just left school and would have been in my father's time. Sadly, he died in 1986. In those days, there were 70 to 80 antique shops on the Ledbury-Westbourne crossroads, so perfect Arthur Daly territory. It was also used for an episode of Only Fools a bit later, probably. Only one or two dealers are still alive, unfortunately, and I don't have their details." So thank you to Paul for his contribution. He mentioned Westbourne Grove. This is the second street you come to which crosses Ledbury Road after Artesian Road. And Paul was absolutely right about Only Fools and Horses. I recalled the Antiques episode immediately, as Yesterday Never Comes. This was a typically great Only Fools episode, featuring the memorable Miranda Davenport, played by Juliet Hammond. The episode was released in 1983, and at that time Ledbury Road looked much the same as in Minder, and it was still full of antique shops. Though in the Only Fools episode it is a very short scene, you can clearly tell it is in the same location, given you can see Wellington Close, the very narrow side street where Terry is left hanging in Whose Wife. Del goes into the antique shop opposite, which by my calculations is today a French designer clothing shop, Petit Bateau. So there was indeed filming down the same road full of antique shops, and in fact they went quite a long way to ensure authenticity for such a short scene. There is for some reason a very huge French connection in this area. Artesian, in fact, is a French word, and even now there seem to be lots of French shops in and around the area. Baudouin Mills, of course, is French-Canadian, and there are French references in the Minder episode. Again, something Tony Horn knew about very early on. Dave Shanks told me that he didn't realise Baudouin Mills' Shirley Bassey connection, but that it didn't surprise him. There is a point in the episode where Gloria talks about Jim and Alex and says, "Fantasy, lies, it's all part of the same thing." She had described Jim as a fantasist, and I always used to think this was a little over the top for the episode, until I realised the inspiration behind the character. I believe that again this is Tony Hall's real-life inclusion within the story of the character. As we said, Shirley Bassey was known for having marriages and relationships with men who were actually gay. It was all a front. Not quite sure why, to be honest, as the gay scene loves Shirley Bassey, so she might as well have just been honest. But back in 1980, when being gay was a little less popular to say the least, Bassey had been married a few times to gay men, but it was a well-kept secret. Here is a clip from her second appearance on This Is Your Life in 1993. Baudouin is called Bo here by Michael Aspel, and you can hear his rather high-pitched camp laugh a few times.
You've been married twice, to an Englishman and to an Italian, but your longest-lasting relationship has been with a Frenchman. Bo, what is the secret?
Oh, simply growing older together.
I'm 29. What are you talking about? You've just ended the longest relationship I've ever had.
He said older, not old. There is a
older, I said. Yeah.
Come on, what's the SP on Gloria?
Oh,
my good God, you never. Oh, Terry, you are disgusting. Gloria Brompton is a personal friend of mine. What's Alex going to say when he finds out, eh?
I don't think it'd bother him too much in the circumstances.
Terry, it's his wife.
Who's his wife? Drive carefully, dear.
Well, this is exciting.
Always watch a bit of telly.
Help yourself to another drink if you'd like.
No, I'm all right. Listen, why did you tell Arthur you'd never met Alex's wife?
I don't know. Didn't want any complications. Bach.
And selling it off, considerably below market value.
Kill you! Kill you!
It wasn't my idea, you know. It was that wife of yours, Gloria.
Gloria?
She came to see me just after the accident. Told me you'd been seeing someone behind my back. A woman.
I'm sure you shouldn't get so excited.
Shut up, Arthur. It's a lie. Whatever that bitch told you is a lie.
She gave me her name and address.
And did you check it out?
Well, no. She was convincing.
Oh, yes, Gloria is convincing. If you'd have bothered to check it out, you'd have found it was probably one of her mates that she persuaded to collaborate.
Yes, but I believed her. I was hurt. It was her that thought up the story about the protection mob. I was to tell you that to worry you, to upset you because you were helpless in here.
And what about my stock?
That was her idea as well. I swear to you, Alex, we would have split the proceeds and I would have had enough to go away somewhere. Start a new life without you. The trouble was, things got complicated when those two arrived. I thought you'd find out, so I hired George and Charlie to make it seem true.
You've done this to me. After all I gave up, after all I'd done for you, you turn me over.
I'm sorry, Alex. Truly I am. I thought I'd lost you. Please forgive me.
In case you want to get in touch with me, my home number. I'll send Terry over with a bill when a bit more convenient.
get you, mate. Takes all sorts.
Oh, Mr. Daly. Mr. Daly. I'd like to have a word with you, please, about this watch I bought from you.
Terry, I think you really will have to have a word with that slippery fellow who sold you this stuff, job lot.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'll take my granny along too, shall I?
So, rounding things up, what do we have here? We have a very tight script, immaculately played by the actors involved, all of whom might well have thought they could have been playing in a TV series which might not last more than another year. We have that script being based on Lord knows what experiences Tony Hoare had himself or things he knew about, but he was sure to include them very specifically, right down to the location itself. Jim was based on Beaudoin Mills, who owned Brompton Antiques in real life under the name Cassio. Mills has a French-Canadian background, which was also the connection with a reference such as Mule Marinier. Even the road the shop and flat are on, Artesian, is a French reference. The script also includes direct as well as hidden references, which make a point about people living secret or double lives, some form of fantasy escapism that others might be unaware of. This is referred to directly as being Jim in the episode, but in real life it was Beaudoin and Shirley Bassey, as well as others like them, including Alex in the episode really, who use a front to cover their real life proclivities. Quite how Tony Hoare knew these things, or wanted to make the point, is unknown. I would love to know all about Tony Hoare and his real life, now that would have made a classic episode. So just look at all of these connections and relations all housed in this one tiny spot on the television landscape, albeit a very special one. In the 70s and 80s, when TV was most popular, in terms of just the two or three channels, we couldn't watch them again. They were almost always a one-off. Thanks to the era in which we now find ourselves, we can indeed watch them again and again. I've watched Whose Wife Is It Anyway some 100 times over the years, by my estimation, thanks to videos, DVDs and the internet. Such close attention to detail that can now be paid was absolutely unthinkable at the time the episode went out. Tony Hoare, I believe, thought he was safe to make many of these near-secret references, but it is all the more impressive that such levels of detail were behind the episode. An episode which is brilliantly acted and entertaining to the point where much of this seems like it was not all that important. Except it was, and without such detailed background, the episode might not have been quite as good. After all, at the time, the Brompton shop was really called Cassio Antiques. What is one meaning of the word Cassio? Empty or vain? Alan Lewis appeared in a number of productions in 1980. One was an episode of The Professionals, The Acorn Syndrome, which featured one Jenny Nevinson. Lewis has not acted since 2017, and around that time he was still playing guitar with a band, in Leeds of all places. Lewis's real-life wife was fellow actor Annette Ekblom, although they divorced in 1986. A year later, David Dacre and Alan Lewis would go on to appear together again in the Boone episode, Smokey and the Band. As you might know, David Dacre also shows up in a later Minder episode, Life in the Fast Food Lane, as Sir Ronald Bates, playing Jan Francis's tetchy father. Both Dacre and Janet Key were in the first Sweeney episode, and Janet was in another episode, as was John Forgem, he with the thatched barnet in Whose Wife Is It Anyway? Further trivia on this is that the very same chap was married in real life to Georgina Hale, the prozzy from The Beer Hunter. David Dacre's real-life wife was a drama teacher who passed away at the age of 86. He, believe it or not, now lives in France. My favourite finding trivia-wise, apart from this whole episode, is that in the film Endless Night from 1972, Alan Lewis's brother, Howell Bennett, plays, wait for it, an antiques dealer. Howell was an interesting character too, of course, and in case you're wondering, Alan Lewis's full name is Alan Lewis Bennett. We'll finish off with the rather ridiculous fact that the Whose Wife episode is no longer shown on British terrestrial television due to potential offensive content. So what of the future when we are not allowed to make light or fun of anything or anyone lest we cause offence? Can you imagine the secrecy Tony Hoare would have to employ these days to get around the censors? It's even more concerning that some people have even commented on Minder fan groups on Facebook to actually question why this should be allowed or shown ever again because of the offensiveness to gays. I think these people are completely missing the point. It was funny in 1980, it's still funny now. It tells you not to be too serious about yourself and to lighten up a little, and preferably, just be yourself. As I said at the beginning of the show, this is the last one of 2024, so I'd like you to wish you all a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. We will be back in 2025, and remember in the meantime, the world is your lobster, my son.